Chapter 27. Dear Charlotte, you have good cause to worry about Lady Amelia and her husband. An American Marine officer is unlikely to tolerate impudence in a wife, and of all your pupils, Lady Amelia seems the most capable of impudence. Your equally impudent cousin, Michael. Now is as good a time as any, Lucas said. Amelia nodded. Not for nothing had she spent the past few nights warming her husband's bed. She knew what he liked, and she'd begun to learn what he expected of her. An obedient wife, wasn't it, no matter what he told himself. But it was time that he learned it. Whenever Amelia tried to reason with him, he balked at the challenge to his authority. She didn't mean to have that battle every time some matter arose that they couldn't agree upon. Nor did she intend to watch him destroy their future, and her family's, because he couldn't put his past behind him. If being obedient was what it took to get him to go to France, she'd do it. Because once he was there, looking at a grave, once he talked to the people in Lisieux, how could he possibly ignore the facts? So she would be obedient tonight if it killed her. And judging from the gleam in her devilish husband's eyes, he meant to make sure that it did. He strode over to her favourite armchair and settled himself in it, then gestured to the bags that had been brought over from Lord Kirkwood's house. You can begin, wife, by unpacking those and stowing everything away. As she nodded and headed for the bags, he said, And I want everything neatly folded. None of your messy habits, do you hear? She gritted her teeth. For the next 2 hours, he barked orders like a general at the front lines, until she started to wonder if she'd been daft to marry a military man. After the unpacking came more intimate duties. He ordered her to remove his coat, waistcoat, cravat, and boots, which he did with the same cool efficiency he always showed. When he commanded her to clean and polish his boots, she had to forcibly hold her tongue. He was giving her a servant's duties when they both knew that officers' wives didn't do such menial tasks. He was trying to bend her to his will as an officer bends a soldier to his. Very well, let him do his best. He'd soon learn the depths of a woman's will. By the time she was done with his boots and they shone to a high gloss, Lucas didn't look quite as smug as when they'd begun. No doubt he'd expected her to give up being obedient before she got to this point. He eyed her for a long while and finally pointed to the door. Your stepmother cut short my dinner, wife. Go downstairs and assemble a tray of food suitable to assuage my hunger, then bring it up. Yes, husband, she said in the same mousy voice she'd used all evening. This time it made him arch one eyebrow. And no purgatives. Certainly not, she said as she turned for the door, though the idea grew more appealing by the moment. She took the back stairs to avoid running into her parents, but then dawdled in the kitchen. He hadn't said to hurry, after all. In fact, there were a number of things he hadn't been specific about. Perhaps it was time she took this obedience game to the extreme. When she returned to the room some time later, with a tray containing black bread, sausage, and stewed apples, her frowning husband had moved to her bed. He was sitting propped against the headboard with his legs stretched out, his stocking feet crossed at the ankles, and his shirt unbuttoned. You took your sweet time, didn't you? He grumbled. The kitchen staff has retired for the night, she said, as if that explained everything. Despite his obvious displeasure, she didn't approach him with the tray after pushing the door shut behind her. Instead, she stood there perfectly still. Well, he said, what are you waiting for? She hid a smile. Your orders. I don't know where you want the tray. With a scowl, he tapped the bedside table beside him. Giving him a servant-like nod, she walked over and placed it there, making sure to give him a thorough glimpse of bosom when she bent over. His sharp intake of breath afforded her some satisfaction. That satisfaction only increased when he hauled her onto his lap. She sat there primly, regarding him with the expressionless gaze of a soldier as he studied her. Then he glanced over at the food, and his scowl deepened. You know I don't like sausage or black bread. You said food. You didn't specify what you wanted. Wouldn't an obedient wife bring what her husband lacks? Blind obedience is what you demanded. Since you didn't say what meal to bring you, I gathered what was ready to hand. She smiled sweetly. I brought you apples, and you like those. I sure do. So why don't you feed me some? His husky voice sent desire curling in her belly. Drat him. If he turned her ploy into a sensual game, she'd never be able to make her point. Then again, perhaps she could use even that to her advantage. All right, she murmured, wriggling her bottom as she reached forward for the fork. Not with that, he said. With your fingers. No doubt he was waiting for her to protest that stewed apples didn't lend themselves to that manner of eating, or complain about his eating on her bed. She wouldn't give him the satisfaction. Forcing a smile, she picked up a slice of apple, dredged it heavily in juice, then carried it, dripping, to his mouth. With the juice trickling down his chin, he ate the apple, then pointed to his jaw. Clean this up. I'll fetch a rag. She started to leave his lap. No, he drawled. Use your mouth. Her mouth? Oh, he was devious. If she licked his chin, matters would progress naturally. So she'd have to thwart him. As you wish, husband, she murmured, then leaned forward and scraped the juice from his jaw with her teeth. Ow! He jerked back to scowl at her. What are you doing? You said use your mouth. You know very well what part of the mouth I meant. She cocked her head. I would never dare to assume. He cut off her words with a kiss, and she nearly responded, seduced by the taste and touch and scent of him. But she caught herself and forced herself to sit unmoving while his mouth caressed hers and his tongue pressed against her closed lips. Kiss me back, he growled. So she did, but only with her mouth. She kept her body still as a stone, her hands folded in her lap. At first, he didn't seem to notice. He plundered her lips as ardently as ever, his tongue driving deep as his hands swept knowingly over her hips, her belly, her breasts. But when she continued just to sit there, he drew back to glare at her. I said, kiss me back. I am. But you're not touching me. I'll be happy to touch you as soon as you tell me what to touch, and how, and when. So that's your game. If I don't give the exact command, you don't act. I'm merely being an obedient... The hell you are. He stared at her a long moment. Fine. I'm more than happy to command you in even the smallest detail, because sooner or later you'll rebel. You can't help yourself. She just stared at him, more determined than ever to continue her campaign of passive resistance. Stand up and take off your clothes, he demanded. Oh, and in case you mean to misinterpret the word clothes, I want you naked. Understand? Perfectly, she said, and rose to her feet. She started out slowly, but within seconds her husband anticipated that teasing tactic and murmured, Quickly, darling, you have 1 minute. To unhook and unsnap and unlace everything? Drat him, he was determined to tax her patience. It took her the full time, so only when she was done and standing there while he looked her over did she realize how unnerving it was to be fully naked before a clothed man. The last time she'd stood naked before him, he'd been naked too. That had felt far, far different. This felt more like their encounter on the Zeebek when she was his captive, but that had been a game with stakes smaller than these, because theirs wasn't a game, it was a war, and it remained to be seen who'd win it. He took his time about looking her over, letting his intimate gaze linger on her unbound breasts, her trembling belly, the rapidly dampening curls at the juncture of her thighs. She had to dig her fingers into her palms to keep from covering herself. When at last he lifted his eyes to hers, she could read in them a determination to conquer her that mirrored her own. "Do you remember our wedding night?" he asked, "when you wanted to watch me pleasure myself?" Warily she nodded. He smiled with all the sly charm of a born seducer. "Now it's your turn. I want to watch you pleasure yourself. Lord help her. A blush spread over her cheeks as she realized what he meant. But she could never, had never. Well, she had, but not like this. She touched herself in the secrecy of her own bed, under the sheets, furtively. This would be utterly mortifying. And he knew it too, the wretch, for his smile broadened. Now, wife, put your hand between your legs and caress your tender parts for my enjoyment. She searched frantically for a way to misconstrue his request, but she was too flustered to think of one. Blushing from head to toe, she did as he demanded. Her flesh was already damp and aroused, but now it seemed to pulse against her fingers so violently that she was sure he could see it. She wouldn't know, however, because she couldn't bear to watch him watch her. He realized that at once. "Look at me, darling," he said in that sensuous drawl that always sent delicious shivers down her spine. She lifted her gaze to find him staring, not at her busy hand, but at her flushed face. "Use your other hand to caress your breasts," he ordered. When she did so, however, he didn't watch that. He just kept watching her face. Then she realized what he was doing. It was her reaction that mattered to him, her embarrassment that he wanted. And perhaps he also wanted to see her lose herself in pleasure and give up the control that he wanted to gain for himself. Ha! Now she knew how to thwart him. So she did exactly as he said, caressing the slick petals of flesh, rubbing her finger over the tight, aching little nodule. But she steeled herself against any reaction, though it took every ounce of her will. She forced herself to caress her body mechanically, as if she were grooming herself or brushing her teeth. It wasn't easy with him watching her, searching her face, hoping for signs of a break in her control. But having his heated gaze on her sparked her temper, making it easier for her to be cool and distant as she worked her fingers over her private parts. The longer she did it, the deeper his scowl became, until his eyes were blazing at her, not just with desire, but with anger. "Come here, damn you." "As you wish, husband." She approached the bed, ruthlessly suppressing her smile of triumph. He could command her to do many things, but he couldn't command her to feel pleasure, and he was finally beginning to realize that. "Undress me," he ordered. "As you wish, husband," she repeated blithely. "And stop saying that," he growled. "All right." She set about undressing him, but it was more difficult than she expected. Not so much because of the awkwardness of getting trousers off a seated man, an aroused seated man, but because she could smell him and feel his breath quick and hot against her cheeks. After she'd stripped him down to his drawers, he launched into a new torment. He began to kiss and touch her. As she worked the buttons free, he kissed her cheek, her brow, her ear. He took down her hair, caressing it, rubbing it, twining it over her breasts over and over. And then, when he had her nipples taut and aching, eager for a firmer caress, he stroked them, but with a feathery touch that could only arouse, not satisfy, until it was all she could do not to shove her breasts in his mouth and beg him to suck them. Which was exactly what he wanted. Beast. Devil. She wouldn't let him win. She would not. She worked his drawers off, fighting to ignore his caresses. But it was not so easy to ignore the rampant erection that reared up before her very eyes, demanding her attention. When he caught her staring at it, he said hoarsely, "Touch me." Her gaze swung to his, and the savage intensity of those dark eyes nearly banished her resolve. But her will was stronger. Holding his gaze with a perfectly cool one of her own, she very deliberately fondled his ankle. A foul oath erupted from him. "You know damn well that I want you to touch my—" He caught himself. "Never mind. I have a better idea. Get up on the bed astride me." She blinked, not quite certain what he meant, but when she climbed up over his legs, he caught her by the waist, then positioned her so that she sat straddling his thighs just below his erection. "Put my cock inside you where your fingers just were," he rasped, leaving no room for misinterpretation. So that's what he wanted. How very intriguing and different, and adventurous. Of course, the devious scoundrel knew exactly how to tempt her to lower her guard. Could she do what he asked without succumbing to him? She could. She must. Tonight she was fighting for their future. Casting him a curt nod that deepened his scowl but didn't seem to dampen his arousal, she maneuvered herself onto his rigid staff, which took some doing since he still sat with his back against the headboard. But when she sank down fully, fitting herself firmly against his groin, he slid his eyes shut with a look of pure ecstasy. "Yes, darlin', like that." His fingers dug into her hips. "Damnation, you feel good." He felt good, too, so good that the urge to move against him was nearly irresistible. But resist the urge she did. She sat there, immobile, careful not to touch him except where they were joined. After a moment, his eyes shot open. "Move, damn it." "All right." She placed her hands on her thighs and stroked in circles. The glare he cast her would have set fire to a glacier. "Up and down, Amelia." Struggling not to smile, she ran her hands up and down her thighs. "Amelia," he said in a warning tone. "Isn't that what you want?" she said innocently. "You know damned well it's not. I want you to make love to me." "Then you'll have to be more specific in your requests," she chirped, enjoying herself. "How exactly do I make love to you? What part should I move first? Where? How often? When do—" "Damn you!" Seizing her head in his hands, he kissed her with a desperation that resonated deeply in her loins. Still she sat there, not touching him, not moving. He ripped his mouth from hers to growl, "An obedient wife would know what I want of her." "She'd be able to read your mind? How extraordinary. I didn't realize that such a talent came along with obedience." She cast him a mischievous smile. "And you know perfectly well that any mealy-mouthed, blindly obedient wife wouldn't be sitting atop your lap unless you demanded it. She'd be too embarrassed, and too busy groveling at your feet. In fact, if I were to be a truly obedient wife—" She started to lift up off his cock, and he caught her to him. "Enough," he growled against her ear. "Enough, you teasing, impudent plague of a woman. Give me what I want, Amelia." "An obedient wife," she whispered, as he skated his mouth over the pulse beating furiously in her throat. He hesitated, then let out a heartfelt groan. "No, you, just you. You're the only one I want." She sucked in a breath, not daring to believe that she'd won. "And in the morning, what then?" His hand slid down to cup her breasts, to rub the nipples erect once more, and his mouth was warm and tender as it laved her ear. "I'll go to France, all right. Just give me my Delilah back." He pumped his hips beneath her as his hands feverishly caressed her breasts. "Please, darling, be my Delilah tonight, because in the morning we begin a very long dry spell." That was all it took to make her move, to have her throwing her arms about his neck and showering his face with kisses. She undulated against him, sliding up and down on his cock, pumping it fervently. They'd never made love this way before, but she felt as if she'd been born to do it. It was the most exquisite sensation yet, having him deep inside her, while at the same time having control, being able to press herself hard against him, exactly where she wanted to feel him hard against her. "Yes," he rasped as she rode his cock in a fever of need. "Yes, Delilah. Yes. Faster, darling. God have mercy. Faster. Faster." She did exactly as he asked. Since she'd won, she could afford to be generous. And he responded to it with all the fervency she could desire, his fingers plucking her nipples, his mouth plundering hers, and giving her such rich pleasure she thought she would die of it. As she ground down upon his cock over and over, the tension building inside her, she tore her lips from his. "Is this what you want?" she demanded, feeling her own release just beyond her, out of her reach. Is this what my big, strapping soldier of a husband wants? You know it is, he said, his voice raw, guttural. He nipped her lip, then soothed it with his tongue. I want you, darling. Just you. She fisted her hands in his hair, her legs aching from the force of her motions. But only if I do as you say. Do as you want. His eyes slid shut. Do as you please. Just don't leave me. Her throat tightened. I won't, she vowed. If you try, I'll hunt you to the ends of the earth. The fierce words sent a thrill coursing through her. It was the closest Lucas had ever come to a declaration of love, and she cradled it to her heart. No need for that. She brushed a kiss to his lips, his closed eyelids. I'll never leave you, my love. At the words love, his eyes shot open to search her face. You won't rest until you have me broken and bleeding at your feet, will you? Leave it to Lucas to see love as defeat. Even as she ground her hips more urgently, feeling the rush to release seize her, she fixed him with a fiery glance. I won't rest until you love me, as I love you. The look of yearning that came over his dark features was so powerful even his scowl couldn't disguise it. God have mercy on me, he groaned, because it's damned certain that you won't. Then they were straining together, pounding, thrusting, lost to anything but each other, to their mutual need and desire and, dare she hope, love. As he spilled his seed inside her and cried out her name with all the fervency of a vow, all the desperation of a prayer, she clutched him close and let her love wash over them both, hoping it was enough, swearing she would make it enough. And long after she collapsed atop him, long after their hearts had settled into a more normal rhythm, and she lay spent and sated across his powerful body, she repeated the vow to herself. She loved him, and somehow she'd teach him to love her. He stretched out and dragged her into his embrace, pressing her head to his chest and brushing her hair with his lips. It was only later, after his breath had grown even and she was certain that he slept, that she roused the courage to say again in a furtive whisper, I love you, Lucas. Then she gave herself up to the sweet exhaustion, tugging her own eyelids closed. When next she awakened, he was gone, and the sun was streaming through her filmy curtains. She jerked upright in a panic, cursing her tendency to sleep like the dead. Surely he wouldn't have left without telling her goodbye. But a cursory examination of the room showed that his knapsack was gone, along with his boots and some of his clothes. An unnamed fear gripping her, she dragged a night trail and a wrapper over her body, then hurried down the stairs. She found Dolly sitting in the breakfast room, staring vacantly out the window. Where's Lucas? Amelia asked. When Dolly turned to Amelia, her eyes were red. Gone to France with your father. Didn't you know? I did, but... She sank into a chair. She'd hoped he might say something before he left, something to give her hope for their future. George suggested that you and I return to Torquay to await their return. The season is ending anyway, and if you stay here, you'll have to deal with gossip about the elopement. She stared down at her hands. This way, we can start the tale that you and Lucas are on your honeymoon. No one need know that you're in Torquay. Besides, if George has to make arrangements to sell the townhouse upon his return... She broke off with a little sob. Oh, Dolly, Amelia said, forcing her own troubles to the back of her mind. She hurried to sit beside her stepmother and put her arm about her shoulders. Everything will be fine, I promise. Lucas will never demand money of Papa, you'll see. And in France he'll find proof that your brother is dead, and that will be an end to it. You believe me about Theo, don't you? Dolly said in a plaintive whisper. You believe I never set out to deceive you? Of course, dearest, of course. Tears slid down her cheeks once more. I wouldn't blame you if you didn't, you know. I saw your husband's evidence this morning, all the banking documents and newspaper reports, and... she broke off with a choked cry. Theo was every bit as bad as your husband claimed, a bounder, a scoundrel, a thief. You didn't know, Amelia said softly.
I did, Dolly protested. Deep down, I suppose I knew. I just didn't want to face it.
When she burst into sobs, Amelia drew her into her arms and murmured soothing nonsense, wondering what she would have done in Dolly's place. Probably brained Theo Fryer with a pitcher, and that wicked fellow in Rhinebeck, too. But that wasn't Dolly's way. She always wanted to believe the best of people, and when she couldn't, she retreated. Or, in the case of those she loved, avoided the truth. Dolly had spent a lifetime hiding from things, and Theo Fryer had taken advantage of that. After a while, when her sobs lessened, Dolly pulled away.
"Listen to me, sweetheart. You mustn't let any of this come between you and your husband. It's all right. No, I mean it."
A soft smile touched her lips.
"I won't have you lose him over me. Anyone with eyes can see that Major Winter adores you."
Amelia's heart tightened in her chest. If he did, he had an odd way of showing it, running off to France without even so much as a kiss goodbye.
"Do you really think so?"
Dolly nodded.
"Of course, your father feels differently. He's too angry to see it."
She gave a small smile through her tears.
"He spent half the night vowing to thrash the Major."
Amelia gave a bitter laugh.
"That's not a surprise. I spend half my days vowing to thrash the Major." "And the other half? How do you spend them?"
Her throat tightened.
"Wanting to hold him so close he can never doubt that I love him."
Dolly beamed at her.
"I'm sure he knows, sweetheart, and I'm sure he loves you, too."
Lord, she hoped so, because she didn't know how she'd survive if he didn't.
Chapter 28
"Dear cousin, Amelia's husband and father have gone to France on an errand neither she nor her stepmother will divulge. It has made my dear pupil very melancholy, which tells me that poor Amelia is in love with the Major. I can only hope for her sake that he feels the same. As I learned very well from my marriage, loving a man who does not love you leads to nothing but disappointment. Your anxious cousin, Charlotte."
"I love you, Lucas."
Lucas had expected those words to eventually lose their power over him. Yet after a week spent crossing the Channel, then trudging across the same French countryside he traversed barely a month ago, they only consumed him more. They glittered in every morning dawn. They beat through every step he took. They swirled maddeningly through his dreams at night. They succored him after every chilling nightmare. At first, he tried to convince himself that Amelia had spoken them only to manipulate him. But after days reliving every moment he'd spent with his wife, he'd given up believing that, if he ever had. Amelia wasn't his mother. If she had been, she would have said she loved him the first time she'd thought it might gain her something, like when she was first ruined. She'd have thrown the words at him when she'd begged him to show her stepmother mercy. She wouldn't have said them after she'd made her point. She wouldn't have burst out with them in the midst of their lovemaking. She certainly wouldn't have whispered them when she thought him asleep. So he had to accept them as truth. She loved him. His bewitching Delilah of a wife loved him. And instead of racing back to England to swear his undying devotion, he was standing in a graveyard in Lisieux with his gruff father-in-law. Throughout their long trip, Lucas and Lord Tovey had discussed Lucas's military career, his prospects as a consul, even his imprisonment at Dartmoor. Lucas had heard about the progress of Lord Tovey's apple orchards, how many sheep had lambed the past spring, and which tenants had done well. The one thing they hadn't talked about was what absorbed them most, their wives. It was as if they feared that talking about the situation would make it real. But now they were staring at a gravestone neither of them could ignore. It read in English, "Here lies Theodore Fryer, beloved brother and friend. May he find the peace in death denied to him in life." Lucas read it with a sinking in his chest. Amelia had been right when she'd said it was revenge that drove him.
because now that he saw the words carved in stone, his disappointment was so overpowering that he realized just how badly he'd wanted Dorothy to be lying.
"It looks authentic," Lord Tovey said beside him.
"Yes."
But they both knew that didn't mean much.
"What shall you do now? We could hunt down that fellow Le Beau who prepared the body for burial. The man maintaining the parish register may not have known where he went, but surely someone does."
The desperation in Lord Tovey's voice struck a powerful chord with Lucas. The man was in a terror that he'd lose his wife, and Lucas knew exactly what that was like.
"We could also speak to the local apothecary," Lord Tovey went on. "Those fellows at the inn said he would return by evening. He might know something more about the death recorded in the parish register."
Lucas sighed. If the apothecary didn't know anything about the death, there would be another trek to find this Le Beau. And for what? So Lucas could prove that Friar was alive, so that he could make sure his revenge hadn't been snatched out from beneath his nose by a twist of fate. In the end, all he'd probably learn is what he'd learned here. Nothing solid. A lot of little things, but no real proof. When Lucas still didn't answer, his father-in-law growled,
"Tell me what to do, Major. Give me some task, or I shall go mad with worrying what you will do to my Dolly."
Lucas tensed, shaken to the soul by such desperation. He understood it only too well. There were some things worth lowering one's pride and begging for. Redemption, mercy, one's wife. Lucas stared at the drawn face he'd come to know well in the past days, at the graying temples and the anguished brown eyes that reminded him so much of Amelia's.
"You believe Friar is dead, don't you?"
The sudden hope in Lord Tovey's eyes was so poignant, Lucas had to look away.
"I do. But whether I believe it is not the question. It's what you believe that counts, and what proof your government will accept."
Lucas was silent a long moment, then finally admitted what he hadn't dared to before.
"As long as they get their money, my government will accept what I tell them. If I make a rubbing of the gravestone, report what I found out here, and give them the death certificate, they'll probably accept my word. For them, the money is what matters."
"Are you sure?" Lord Tovey said hoarsely.
"Yes. The one who cared most about seeing Friar dragged back to stand trial was me. If I proclaim him dead, they'll accept that he is, since they know how fiercely I wanted him captured."
"Ah,"
Lord Tovey replied, a wealth of meaning in that word. Clearly he understood after a week what Amelia had recognized that night in London, that Lucas was driven by far more than the embezzlement. Lucas wanted justice for his father and for himself, and he could finally acknowledge that he wasn't likely to get it, at least from Friar. He'd had plenty of time over this trip to review his evidence in light of Lady Tovey's claims. Things he had ignored before now loomed larger in his memory, like the evasive manner of Dorothy's former employer when Lucas had asked why the woman left, or the trail of good reports she'd left behind her wherever they lived. He'd been so determined to see her as a manipulative seductress that he'd made the evidence fit, because it suited him, because it suited his hate. Because his search had given him something to live for when his whole life had been one long measure of grief. But finally, he had a chance at something other than grief, a wife who suited him, who wanted to bear his children and have a life with him, who loved him. He gave a shuddering breath as he faced his wife's father.
"So you would stake your honor, everything you stand for, on the belief that your wife is telling the truth?"
Lord Tovey stared him down.
"I would be a fool not to. I've spent 2 years learning her moods, finding out what will bring tears to her eyes and what will make her laugh. 2 years of breakfasts and dinners together. 2 years of memorizing every freckle on her dear face. 2 years of knowing when she is lying and when she is telling the truth."
Lucas lifted an eyebrow.
"You didn't know she had a brother?"
"No, but I knew she had a past."
Lucas blinked. Apparently he hadn't been the only one hiding things.
"Despite what you think," Lord Tovey continued, "my wife is not particularly adept at deception. I guessed after a week of marriage that Obadiah Smith was a clear invention,
for no woman who'd ever been married could have been as continuously surprised by the intimacies of marriage as my shy wife. After a month, I realized that she had some dark secret plaguing her. But I never pressed her, because I knew she'd tell me when she was no longer afraid of losing me, if she did. His voice shook. When she could finally accept that I loved her too much ever to let anything separate us. A lump lodged in Lucas's throat. You're as much a romantic as Amelia, who, by the way, never realized any of what you realized about your wife. She believed Dolly was innocent from the very first, no matter what I said.
That's because Amelia desperately wanted a mother, and Dolly gave her that, and because my daughter couldn't imagine that anyone she loved would ever deceive her in anything but the most superficial manner. When she gives her trust, she gives it with her whole heart, and it would take a powerful effort for anyone she loved to destroy that trust.
I can't live with a man I can't trust.
And could she trust him now? Would she be able to trust him in the future? She'd said that as long as he went to France and confirmed Dorothy's story, she would live with his decision about what to do after that. But he was no fool. If he dragged her family's name through the mud in some vain attempt to draw out a man who might very well be dead, she would never recover from it. It would chip away at her trust of him as surely as his evasions had done. He would lose her. And suddenly, that was just one sacrifice too many in his life. "Well, then," he said, turning toward the entrance to the cemetery. "We're done here. I think it's time to go home." 2 weeks had passed since Amelia's father and husband had gone off to France, and she was fit to be tied. Torquay wasn't a lively town in the best of times, but in her current state it was excruciating. With little to occupy her, she had far too much time to worry about Lucas. The one bright spot was that she and Dolly spent a great deal of time together. That's when Amelia realized how difficult it must have been for Dolly to deceive them all, because now that she could speak freely, she couldn't stop talking. She told Amelia about her parents, her childhood in New England, her awful time as a housekeeper in Rhinebeck. She seemed so relieved that her mood was lighter than it had ever been, despite the worry about the future hanging over both their heads. Clearly, the secrets of her past had plagued her for some time, and it took an enormous weight off her to have them out in the open. So perhaps Lucas had done some good after all, as long as he didn't cart Dolly off to America. After a suitable time of pretending to be on her honeymoon, Amelia resumed her correspondence with Venetia. Desperate for news, she wrote her friend daily, claiming that she and Lucas were spending time in the country before returning to London. From Mrs. Harris, who knew about Lucas's trip to France, she learned that Lord Pomeroy had come to town and spoken nary a word about her or Lucas. But word had leaked out about his perfidy, and while some dismissed it as rumor, others were giving him the cut direct at parties. More importantly, parents were more careful with their daughters around him, which relieved Amelia enormously. From Venetia, however, she heard nothing. She found that odd, given that her first letter had been a lengthy account of her and Lucas's encounter with the Scottish scourge. Of course, the London papers had already covered it, quoting the Kirkwoods' description of the affair and lauding Major Winter and his wife for their successful escape. But Amelia wanted to hear what Venetia might tell her privately about the Scottish scourge. So when a letter finally arrived from her early one morning, Amelia seized on it eagerly. But it merely raised more questions. "Now, dearest friend, regarding your bizarre experience on the roads in Scotland, I confess I had no idea when I read the newspapers that I had some part in your abduction. How appalling! But I don't know what it means. I still have no idea why this Scottish scourge fellow is plaguing Papa, and Papa says he doesn't either. Unfortunately, he's had another of his painful spells, which is why I've taken so long to answer your letter. And in his present condition, I fear to press him on the matter. But you can be sure that as soon as he is better, I will do so." The letter went on to beg information about what married life was like. Amelia didn't know whether to smile or weep as she read it, or how she could answer. But even as she pondered it, a servant rushed into the drawing room.
"The master's home, milady, he's home!"
Her heart pounding, Amelia raced into the hall, arriving at the same moment as Dolly, who threw herself into her husband's arms with a cry of joy. Lucas was nowhere to be seen.
"Papa," Amelia asked, "where is my husband?"
Her father was too busy hugging his wife to even spare Amelia a glance.
"He'll be along this evening," he said. "He had something to attend to first."
Her heart sank.
"Something regarding Dolly?"
Her father's gaze shot to her.
"No, dear, no. I see I have arrived before the letter I sent from France, but everything is fine."
He stared tenderly down at Dolly.
"Major Winter has decided not to pursue the matter further. He's going to make a full report on your brother's death to his government. We'll arrange to have the rest of the stolen money repaid, and that will be an end to it."
A rush of relief hit Amelia, so profound that her knees went weak.
"So where is he?"
"He went to Dartmoor Prison, said he wanted to see it now that it's empty."
"And you let him go alone?" Amelia cried. "Are you mad? That will set him to thinking about all his wrongs again, for heaven's sake."
She ordered the footman to fetch her police and hat. Her father watched her in clear alarm.
"Now, see here, he'll be fine. There are some things a man should do alone."
"That may be," she snapped, as the footman helped her on with her police. "But this is not one of them."
"Amelia," her father began.
"Let her be, George," Dolly shocked her by saying. "It's not more than a few hours by coach, and if it will ease her mind, she should go."
She laid her head on his chest.
"It has been a long wait for both of us, you know."
Amelia's father softened. He never could resist Dolly.
"Whatever you wish, dear heart."
He glanced at his daughter.
"We docked in Plymouth, but he was still trying to find someone willing to drive him the 30 miles to Princetown when I left. So if you leave now and take my carriage, you might arrive there shortly after he does. Take a footman with you."
"Of course." She kissed her father on the cheek. "Thank you, Papa."
A short while later, she headed for Princetown. Although Dartmoor Prison was in Devon, she'd never been there. And 2 hours later, as the coach climbed higher and higher, she realized why. Because no one with any sense would come willingly to such a desolate spot. Still a wilderness part of England, the rocky outcroppies and impassable bogs and mires of the barren moor were legendary. She'd heard that it was often plagued by fog, but today it was clear, affording her a grim view of Dartmoor Prison's distant granite walls. Ugly and remote, the prison was flanked on one end by Princetown, a town there only to serve the prison. As her coach drove through it, she saw few signs of life. Now that all the prisoners were gone, the town seemed to be languishing. As her carriage approached the prison proper, her heart sank to think of Lucas locked up in that inhospitable place, plagued continually by damp and cold, with nothing but a bleak vista as far as the eye could see. As she imagined him forced to obey the dictates of men as arrogant as himself, to endure the many petty humiliations inflicted upon prisoners of war, her heart sank further. Even if he'd resigned himself to giving up on his revenge before, seeing this place would surely renew it. How could it not? She had no trouble finding Lucas, for as she drove up, he was standing in front of the stone arch entrance. Apparently he'd walked up from the town, for there was no carriage nearby. If he heard the approach of her carriage, he made no sign, for he didn't alter his military stance. His arms remained folded behind his back, and his feet set slightly apart as he gazed at the locked wooden gates. He wore his uniform, not the one she'd seen at the ball, but a different one, without the red sash. It hung on him, and with wifely concern, she wondered how well he'd been eating, or sleeping, since passage to France had probably required his going below decks. He looked so lost in thought that she was careful to warn him of her approach by speaking his name before she reached him. He hesitated a second, then swung around, his face mirroring his surprise.
"Amelia, what are you doing here?"
She managed a smile, though his drawn features made her want to weep.
"I didn't think this was the sort of place you should come to alone."
To her relief, he returned her smile with a faint one of his own.
"Afraid I'd run mad over the moor, were you?"
"A
Afraid you'd forgotten you had a wife, more like, she said lightly, though her heart was in her throat. He held out his arms, and she went into them eagerly, not even resisting when he hugged her so tightly she could scarcely breathe.
I missed you, he murmured into her hair. I missed you every moment I was away.
I see how much you missed me, she teased, choking back tears. Instead of coming home to me, you came to this nasty old prison. With a chuckle, he drew back, but didn't release her, just turned to face the prison gates with one arm looped about her waist.
I was saying goodbye, he said.
To what?
To everything. The war, my parents.
He dragged in a breath.
My revenge. You were right, you know. My pursuit of Friar wasn't about justice. It was mostly about revenge, but not just against him.
His fingers dug into her.
Against the English, for this travesty. For men held beyond the rightful time, men kept from returning to their families, men murdered in cold blood.
Men locked in tunnels beneath the ground, gasping for breath.
He nodded. In my mind, Dartmoor marked the beginning of my troubles. I was convinced that if it hadn't been for the prison, I would have been home and able to help my family. Friar wouldn't have been able to embezzle the money, or if he had, I would have caught up to him before he could spend it, while he was still able to exonerate my father.
A thoughtful expression crossed his face.
But the truth is, I could still have been elsewhere after the war ended. The Marines returned to Algiers in 1815, and other events might have kept me from home, especially since I was never eager to be around my parents' constant bickering. Dartmoor didn't mark the beginning of my troubles. It was just another tragedy of war.
A shuddering breath shook him.
That's the hardest part to face, that there's no one to blame, no one to punish.
Not even Theodore Friar? She asked hesitantly.
He cast her a thin smile. Not even him. He's dead, you know.
She sagged against him, her relief so profound it made her knees weak.
He's dead, and so is this place.
He regarded the rusty padlock on the gate with a pensive look.
I expected to find it the same as it was when I was here, redcoats marching and prisoners in ill-fitting yellow jackets. But of course it isn't, because life goes on.
He gestured to the weeds growing in cracks of the abandoned prison's walls.
Time erodes everything eventually, doesn't it?
Not everything, she murmured, then gathered her heart in her hands and offered it. Not love.
He sucked in a breath. No, not love.
Turning her toward him, he cupped her cheek.
That's really why I came here today, to be sure I could put it behind me, to see if I could be the man you need.
And what did you decide? She asked in an aching whisper.
I have no choice. I love you, Amelia.
His eyes burned into hers, tender, tortured.
I can't bear to live even one day more without you. So if keeping you means forgetting my past, then I will try.
Her heart filled with joy. I'm not asking you to forget your past, my love. I'm just asking that you not let it ruin your present. She slid her arms about his neck. Or our future.
I won't, he vowed,
then kissed her with all the love she could ever want. The cough of her father's coachman reminded her they weren't alone, and he drew back with a blush. We should probably retire to a more private place.
Like a consulate in Morocco? He asked.
She gazed at him, startled.
Among the mail waiting for me when we returned from Scotland was a letter offering me the position of an American consul. I read it the morning your father and I left for France.
You mean the morning you left me without a goodbye? She said archly.
He cast her a rueful grin. I was afraid to wake you, afraid that seeing you in all your naked glory might dim my resolve.
His grin faded.
I should have realized my resolve was dimmed the second I found you, lurking outside my room, plotting to thwart me by fluttering your eyelashes and calling me a big, strapping soldier.
She ran her hands over his shoulders. You are a big, strapping soldier. My big, strapping soldier.
Soon to be your big, strapping consul. A mischievous glint appeared in his eye. If the pesky wife I've acquired, the one who gets annoyed when I make decisions without asking her, agrees to it. That's why I haven't answered the letter yet.
Sobering, he searched her face.
I know you like adventures, darling, but after everything we've been through since we met, life abroad might have lost some of its appeal. The conditions may be primitive, and since your dowry will help repay what Friar stole, our income will be pretty modest. We won't be able to afford...
Lucas, she began in a warning tone.
I'm just saying that the only crocodile crockery we'll be buying is whatever you find in the cheap bazaars in Tangier.
Tangier? The very word conjured up delightful images of mosaics and houris and dangerous desert expeditions. Will I get to ride a camel?
He broke into a smile.
If you won't.
Hell, darling, if you agree to live with me in Morocco, I'll make sure you even get to eat a camel.
Riding one will be quite sufficient, thank you. Very well, I consent to your accepting the position, but under one condition.
And what is that? He asked, with a lift of one thick eyebrow.
That you don't expect me to be an obedient wife.
With a laugh, he took her arm and led her toward the carriage.
I don't think I could live with you if you were. The last time nearly killed me.
Really?
Her mind raced ahead to their next sensual encounter.
In that case...
Oh, no, you don't, he growled as he lifted her into the carriage. You were right about that too, darling. I don't want an obedient wife.
As he joined her on the seat inside, he took her in his arms.
What I want is a loving wife.
Thank goodness, because that, my dear husband, you already have.
Epilogue. Dear cousin, I'd received the loveliest gift from dear Amelia Winter last week, a teapot in the shape of a camel. She also sent news that she is once more expecting a child. She says that Major Winter is delighted and does not try to restrict her movements too terribly much. But knowing our Amelia, no matter what he tries, she will prevail. Your friend, Charlotte.
The sun was setting west of Tangier when a noise in the hall of the American Legation building made Lucas turn from the open French doors of his new study. Seconds later, his wife and brown-eyed daughter Isabel burst into the room, followed closely by the young Moroccan nursemaid they'd hired to care for her once Amelia had learned she was expecting another child.
"And where have you been, young lady?"
Lucas made himself look stern, though his minx of a daughter was already giggling, hard enough to shake her chestnut curls.
"Don't tell me you've been off getting into trouble."
"Not trouble, Daddy," Isabel cried. "Adventure."
He didn't know whether to laugh or groan. His little sweetie wasn't quite three yet, and she could already lisp the word adventure. He glanced at his smirking wife and lifted one eyebrow.
"This is all your fault. Just imagine, if our daughter is eager for adventure at this age, our son will probably leave the womb brandishing a pistol."
"You do realize we might not have a boy," Amelia said, eyes twinkling as she rubbed her thickening belly. Dolly said that she felt her quickening at 5 months for young Thomas, but some time later for baby Georgiana. "I'm already at 5 months and haven't felt it, so the baby may be a girl."
"God have mercy on me if it is," he teased. "I can hardly handle the two females I already have."
He smiled at his daughter.
"Well, sweetie, what do you think will happen if Mama gives you a little sister?"
"More adventure, Daddy," she crowed.
He chuckled.
"Probably."
Tucking his thumbs in his trouser pockets, he gazed down at her.
"So what sort of adventure did you and Mama have this afternoon while Daddy was at an audience with the Sultan? Did you herd fish in the bay, write messages for pirates, beat a brigand?"
Isabel laughed, the sweet sound warming him to the soul.
"Daddy, silly,"
she said, holding out her arms. He scooped her up with a mock growl.
"Silly, am I? I'll show you silly, you little wiggle worm."
And he pretended to eat her ear as she giggled and squirmed.
"We toured all the rooms and made a list of what will be needed," his wife said. "This place is amazing. Does your government have any idea how valuable this property is?"
"If they don't, I'll make sure I tell them."
He He jiggled Isabel on his hip. So you like it, do you?
Like it? Amelia beamed at him. It's magnificent. There are enough rooms for us to have as many children as we please, and we're right in the heart of the city. There are courtyards and fountains and...
And this. He gestured out the French doors. Come see. With Isabel in his arms, he took Amelia out onto the fourth-floor terrace, then pointed. When it's clear, as it is now, you can see Gibraltar from here.
Goodness gracious, Amelia whispered, as they took in the vista before them, the bustling harbor, the shining blue straits of Gibraltar, and even the old city itself. As the three of them stood gazing out across the straits, the peace of pure contentment stole over Lucas. He'd never expected to have this heaven of a life, to have an adoring wife, a lively daughter, and the expectation of other children. Dartmoor was a distant memory, and so were his nightmares. He hadn't had one since he'd left France 3 years ago. He could even, when necessary, tolerate going below decks on a ship. Not that he wanted to. He enjoyed being a consul, enjoyed the periods of quiet, punctured by moments of sheer surprise. And his income had proved more than adequate for their needs. They actually lived very well. They hadn't touched the money his father-in-law insisted upon sending them monthly in an attempt to repay what his wife's brother had stolen. And Amelia even got to have her exotic dishes, not to mention exotic Berber rugs, exotic visits to the Sultan's palace, and an exotic ride on a camel. And now, this. After 3 years of living in modest lodgings, they'd been shocked when the Sultan had taken it into his head to give the American legation a consulate that amounted to a palace. They'd moved in today, and Amelia had already set herself to making it into a home. Isabel wriggled in his arms, having lost interest in the view.
Daddy, down!
Laughing, Amelia took the child and went back inside to give her to the nursemaid with instructions to feed her supper and prepare her for bed. When Amelia came back, Lucas wrapped his arm about her waist, and they returned to admiring the view. After a moment, she laughed. I should write Lord Pomeroy and tell him that I can see Gibraltar whenever I please. Pomeroy. He hadn't thought of that scoundrel in a long time. What's the general doing these days? Do any of your many correspondents ever say? He finally found a wife. Can you believe it? Some Italian countess worth a fortune. I'm sure they'll be very happy together, as long as she doesn't mind polishing his opium pipe from time to time. At the tart comment, he glanced down to find her gazing at him with eyes agleam. She wore one of her brightly hued Moroccan gowns, the ones that always heated his blood and set his pulse racing. Judging from her sultry smile, his temptress of a wife knew just what effect the gown had on him, too. Speaking of polishing, he said as he drew her back inside. We've been so busy preparing for the move these past few days that my sword has grown a mite rusty. It could use some attention.
Really?
She cast him a teasing glance.
I shall fetch a rag at once.
You don't need a rag, he growled as he dragged her into his arms. Your hand will be good enough.
For a sword as fine as yours? Hardly. I'll need a rag and polish and...
He cut her off with a kiss that was hotter than the desert sun. When she pulled back some time later, she was smiling, as only his Lady Delilah could.
Very well. I suppose we can make do with my hand.
Her gaze turned seductive.
Or my mouth. Or any number of things suitable for worshipping a man's fine weaponry.
Craving a little adventure, are you? He murmured as his fine weaponry made an instant response.
Always.
She tugged him toward their new bedchamber.
When it comes to the man she loves, a woman can never have too much adventure.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Never Seduce a Scoundrel by Sabrina Jeffries. Copyright 2006 by Deborah Gonzalez. Performed by Justine Eyre. Performance copyright 2009 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at
www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.